everything's got to be shown within about 3 minutes. Those days, the art of a good jobber was to completely hide what he'd done and give the other jobbers the impression that instead of actually having bought the shares, he'd actually sold them. So this was supposed to be very clever. Well, it is actually, because under these circumstances, the price wouldn't change radically, and you wouldn't be in a position where you might lose a lot of money on having sold 100,000 shares.
Well, how would you conceal what you were doing if you were putting your prices on the board?
Ah, but you didn't always... you might change the price, but it needn't necessarily be correct.
Oh.
I mean, so there was no... say, for example, you sold the shares at £1, a lot of shares. Well, in order to be clever, you would mark the shares down to 19 and 9 or something like that, you see, so that the other jobbers would think you probably bought the shares. So this was all part of the skillful back and forth play in the art of jobbing.
Wouldn't you be misleading the brokers then, as much as the jobber?
Well, they were. You could possibly be, but there again, if you were foolish enough not to know what was going on, you were trying to be a little bit too clever. Maybe the broker knew that the shares were going to be tipped, and that was why he was buying them. So what would happen? You maybe put the price down, and then you'd probably go and sell some more, which you obviously didn't want to do. Instead of being able to take a good profit on what you'd just done, you found that you'd managed to completely mess up the whole thing. So, in which case, if you'd done that, you would have realized your mistake, that there was something going on. So immediately then you think, well, I've been very foolish. I must shove the price up in order to get these shares back, which I haven't got. So you then might call them 20 no penny halfpenny fourpence halfpenny or something like that, and because you've been stupid. So although you say you might be misleading the public, they would think that they were, and they knew what was going on,
yes,
they would be able to take advantage
of
you.
Yes, so, yes, that's what I meant, brokers coming up and doing the opposite to what you wanted to do.
Yes. So if you do that, you know, well, then I haven't been all that clever. I'm not fooling anybody. I've got to fall in with what the rest of the market's doing. I've made a mistake and I'll have to cut it.
Were there ever times when that happened to you?
Oh, yes, several times. After all, the I would say 30% of the bargains which you do are not good ones. You've just got to hope that the majority of the bargains you do you make money on, but obviously you can't make money on everything.
Who do you feel you learnt your jobbing skills from?
I think it's a thing which you pick up, actually. I wouldn't necessarily say that I learnt them from members of the firm. I might have learnt them from the opposition, seeing how they worked. Because after all, it was... the majority of the people that you dealt with or who were in the market, you were extremely friendly with. You didn't obviously tell them what you were doing, but you had a very good association. One used to see them in the evenings and things like that, and maybe discuss, if you thought it relative, discuss what you'd done during the day. So.
Really? Jobbers from that period who stand out in your recollection as people who may have influenced you, or stand out as characters or people?
Yes, there were actually, in those days, there were far more characters than there are now, because obviously the place lent itself to characters in those days. As regards the people who were the other jobbers in the market, there were two or three, you know, who were always, I shall always remember. One with Frisbee and Brothers, which was our main opposition, was exceptionally hot. See, the idea, or the principle of the thing in those days when you were jobbing, is that if a broker came round and dealt with you, and his order was unsatisfied, that is, if he had an order in 50,000 and you only sold him 10,000, and there were no strings attached to it, that means that he was entitled to go round and buy the rest elsewhere. He would then start travelling round the market, you see. And it meant that the person that he'd first dealt with was not entitled to go around the market and try and pick up the shares cheaper from another jobber. And this often happened because Frisbee were the main jobbers. And you generally found that the broker went to Frisbee first. And you often found that this particular chap, as this chap was traveling around the market, would immediately fly over to you and say, you got anything in so-and-so? And you might sell him the shares. And then 2 or 3 minutes later, you'd find the broker come round to you. And you know perfectly well that you've been picked up by this other chap. And, but that, of course, was not recognised. That was a very dirty thing to do. And so consequently, one was always very careful of this particular individual. And of course, amongst the brokers too, there were lots of very sharp people who you didn't really particularly like dealing with. So when they ever came to see you there, you generally made them a wide price and told them where to go.
Mm. So that's how it... In general terms, what would make you feel unfriendly towards a broker?
Well, I suppose when a broker tries to be too sharp and tells you a lot of lies about what that you are the first person he's been to, and he and you're not, he you find out that he's been round the market previously, and obviously, if you are told lies, you have really no faith. You don't really want to know the broker because you're never going to make any money out of him. And lots of people have this reputation, or they used to have that reputation. And of course, they found it extremely difficult to deal. It's not in their own interest to be untrue with the jobbers. After all, they've got to live there. That was the old saying. You've got to live with these people. And if you aren't honest with them, well, you won't be trusted.
Did that type of broker begin to drop out? Or would you say there was always an element in the stock exchange?
Up to the time of Big Bang, I'd say. Because after Big Bang, everything was much more open. Everything was reported on the screen. You didn't have the opportunity of trying to hoodwink the jobbers, and the jobbers didn't have the opportunity of hoodwinking the brokers, for that matter. So, all in all, I suppose Big Bang has been very helpful.
In what ways would a jobber hoodwink a broker?
Well, in the price which he would make. Now, a broker would come to you in all good faith, and you'd make him a price, which is probably the right price. And after all, a jobber has got a pretty long memory, and he probably remembers that if this broker is a seller, he remembers him buying the shares. After all, this is part of the art of jobbing. And maybe it's 3 months has elapsed, and the price of the shares has gone up quite a bit. So he remembers that this chap has probably got a selling order, especially when he mentions the number of shares which he wants to deal in. But this is after he's made the provisional price, and the broker says, well, I want to deal in 85,000. and your memory goes back and says, yes, he bought 85,000. Obviously, he's come out here to sell them. So you say, well, that's a large number of shares to deal in. And you load the price the other way, you see. Mm. So you say, well, they're, for example, if they're 55, 60. And he says, well, I'd like a price in 85,000. And you say, well, you know, they're 52, 62 in that number of shares. So maybe you say, well, I'd like to improve a bit on it. And maybe you come in 50, or maybe you then realize what he is. So you come and say 53 or 52, 61. So you know which way he is. And ultimately, of course, he sells them to you at 52, which maybe it's the wrong price. And maybe you've made him 55, 60. And maybe you have a buyer at 57 or something like that. So you're going to get a big turn on it. So that's how the broker is taken for a ride slightly under those conditions, when you know which way he is, because normally speaking, you make a price and you haven't the faintest idea whether he's a buyer or seller, as you learned. But that's how it works.
Was there any open bidding or open offering in the rubber market? Because it did take
There
place
used to be. It seemed to die out. Before the war, I believe, there was a tremendous amount of that open bidding going on. But when I joined, it was noticeable. But obviously not with the younger people, because they didn't really have enough courage to do it. My father used to do it. He used to go out to lunch and come back and start bidding up for shares, which was a complete hallucination or imagination on his part. He didn't, but nobody would deal with him because they thought he knew more than they did, you see. So they were. He could get, back in the early 50s, he could get a share up from about 2 shillings to 3 shillings just by bidding in the market for them. Although he didn't know anything, he thought he'd have a bit of fun, you see, and get the price up. And then the next morning it was back to what it was before, you see. So there were, all these tricks went on and, you know, it was all taken in very good part, I must say.
Mm. How did the rubber market developed during the 50s? You mentioned that it went through a very bad period. Did it improve?
Yes, it did. And then there was a boom in 1952 when the price of the raw material went up to about, I think around about 50p. And then it came back fairly suddenly. It was due to the Korean War, I think. You know, there was a shortage of spot rubber. They couldn't get the stuff over here or wherever they wanted to get it to. But that soon got itself straightened out. And then up to about 1958, nothing went on at all. And then in 58, 59, there was another rubber boom. Mm. The price improved dramatically. And of course, the thing about this is that all these rubber shares were on very high yields. They were over 20% yields. So this is why they were always very popular with the public. They always used to say, put your little bit in rubber. And there was it was a good saying, because every portfolio had rubber shares in it. And then again, it fizzled out. And then about 1960, the unit trust started. Mm-hmm. And one of the first things they decided on buying was rubber shares on their high yields, because they made good mixes, you know, with some of the stocks which were only giving 2 or 3%. Unit trusts, M&G, and Ebor, some of these very well-known unit trusts, you know, started buying rubber shares. And that's when the market really started off, about 1963. All the shares, and there were millions of them, started going into the hands of the unit trusts.
Mm. Were the shops still very active?
No, the shops weren't active at all.
What had happened to them?
Well, the shops were in a peculiar sort of position because all the shops rather controlled their own shares. You see, something like Harrison and Crossfields had about a dozen companies, and they were all cross holdings in them, so that it was very difficult to kind of get control. They were never worried about what was going on because nobody could get control of them. Some of the smaller ones might have been a bit worried, but the majority of them were in big groups. M.P. Evans, Barlow, and, you know, a lot of well-known names. They all had around about a dozen companies, and they all had cross-holdings, or otherwise they had in an investment company which held the shares. So they were never really particularly worried.
Mm-hmm. Was there ever situations when a shop had too much control over a share, and you had, for example, what I believe happened in the West African market, where, you know, they could effectively rig a market and get the prices up and down as they desired?
Yes. I don't think that they did that very much. They were quite happy, you know, to let things go as they wanted, or as the public wanted. They were permitted to buy, I think it was 1% each year, which they did. And after all, I suppose quite a lot of the companies, which they were, of the Harrison and Crossfield companies, because as you know, they covered a very big span. They had, you know, in the 40s, 40%, holding in them, so it didn't matter to them. But these shares, of course, had tremendous rises. They were standing around about 5p in the early 60s and went up to over £4. There were a lot of them like that that were worth absolutely nothing because of land values in Malaysia. They went up from about £200 an acre to about £2,000 an acre. So it led to a very exhilarating sort of market, as you can imagine. And it was a market which one could never be short of shares, because you never knew what was round the corner. So one was always rather a bull jobber in those stocks. And it had a bad effect if you were dealing in anything else, because one should never really be a one-sided sort of job, and one should always be prepared to, you know, sell stock that you haven't got. But and as I have explained, in this particular case, you daren't be short, because something nasty could always happen to you.
Do you have any recollections of having been?
Yes, several times it's happened.
Could you perhaps describe one?
Well, you mean in a kind of bid situation?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, some of these bid situations were, you know, pretty frantic. Maybe you might be dealing on a share around about 50p. Probably a better case was Guthrie, which was standing at £6. And the Malaysian Pelmadula Unit Trust came in for a bid to boost their holding to 30%. They had 25%. They wanted to boost it up to 30%. And they came in and bid £9. That was a 50% rise on the price just one morning. And it was a dawn raid. Anyway, they were able to pick out quite a few of them, and we were able to, we supplied them with stock which we hadn't got. We sold, I think our opposition sold 200,000 and we sold 200,000 at £9, which was what they were bidding. So that they were then able to say that they had their 30% and were no longer in the market, or this is what we assumed. But as the morning went on, we discovered that they were not all that satisfied with the 30%, because other people had been very sorry that they'd missed the opportunity of selling on the shares at £9. So they went on to this Pilmadullan unit trust and said, "You know, we'd like to sell our shares too." As you can imagine, we were short of 200,000. And although they were coming in, you know, around about £8.50 or so, because we dropped the price when they were satisfied, it suddenly turned out at 11 o'clock that they were quite prepared to go up to 52% and take control of the company. So it's this sort of thing, as you can imagine, which is gives you practically a heart attack on the spot. Because normally speaking, if you satisfy a 30% a 30% buyer, you expect the shares to drop back, but they didn't do so. They did for a half an hour or so. And then they came up with an a complete bid for the company. This sort of thing adds to the excitement, as you can imagine. And,
We were able to close your positions.
Oh yes, I was able to close the position at a profit, and we had an extremely good day of them, needless to say, because the number of shares which changed hands was enormous.
Was there much tipping going on in those days?
Oh yes, they were always being tipped, actually. The old adage was always sell on a tip, but sometimes, you know, they never came back. Because ever you were on these tips, the majority of people knew that they were going to go in the paper, and it was the poor suckers who bought them on the paper tip, you know, the public, which I wouldn't say that is quite true, because as I say, sometimes they never came back. But a lot of people seemed to know that they were going to be tipped. And I must say, I would never buy a share on a tip. That's it.
Well, let's take up the story of your career with Robert Moy again. You mentioned that in 1959, you joined C.D. Clark.
That's right, yes.
What were the circumstances there?
Well, the thing was that my father was at the time about 80. And he wasn't particularly well. And I knew the people with C.D. Clark extremely well. And they wanted us to join forces, you see.
What kind of firm were they? Were they also
They were in industrial. They were in mostly food shares. And they wanted to branch out. They'd had a good year in 59. The whole stock exchange had a good year in 59. Excuse me. So we joined up with them. But there again, in the early 60s, the stock exchange kind of fizzled out again. See, that was the trouble. There was, in those days, the firms were fairly small, and if there wasn't much business going on in a certain market, you were in a very vulnerable position. So there wasn't really very much going on in any market. Also, one of the partners was being extremely difficult. So the senior partner decided that, he'd like to call it a day. And so the firm packed up in 1967. And then I joined Frisbee, which was our main opposition. They wanted me to join them for. But there again, that didn't last for very long. That only lasted for a year. And then in 1968, I joined Smith Brothers. And of course they said that I had the kiss of death about me after having three firms in 2 years. But this was naturally a joke. At least I hope it was.
What kind of firm were Frisbee Brothers in 67?
Well, they were purely rubber. And they were still the leading jobbers in... But the senior partner, Cyril Frisbee, had died. And they didn't really have sufficient funds, you know, to carry on. And they didn't... And they didn't have a great deal of faith in the rubber market. But there again, it was from 1968 to about 1982, 14 years, where there was the whole complexion of the rubber market completely changed. And in that time, a tremendous amount of money was to be made, all because of the unit trusts, institutions. Everybody bought rubber shares, and everybody did so fantastically well out of them. There were bids for them. And the price of land went up, as I say, from £200 to £2,000 an acre. Mm. And in some of the land, which was used for building, went up to £7,000 an acre. So you can see from about a few pence, they went up to pounds. Mm. Mm. And it naturally created a tremendous amount of interest. It was the market of the stock exchange for 14 years. And if you were always a bull, you know, you couldn't help but make money. Mm. And of course, we were the blue-eyed boys then.
Mm. Were there other firms who persisted with the rubber market?
No, there were only two. There was only Pynchon and ourselves.
Mm. And how did you come to join Smith Brothers? Was it through...
Well, you see, contact? As I said earlier, they took over a firm called Dickinson and Duncombe. So they were in the rubber market. And when they heard that Frisbee was closing down, that was the third jobber, you see. They obviously wanted somebody who knew more about the market than the chap they had who was running it, who wasn't an expert. I knew, obviously, having been in the market since 1947, I knew a lot about the market and how it worked and so forth. So they were quite glad to... you know, have somebody who knew a bit more than their dealer, who was really an industrial dealer, a dealer in the industrial market.
How would you describe Smith Brothers in 1968? Were they a big firm?
No, they weren't. They only had about 25 dealers. And I should think, you know, there were not more than about a firm of about 75 people. And now it's about 1,300 or 1,400 people. You saw the results, yeah. So it was a very small firm, and it specialised mostly in industrial shares. And also, of course, South Africans. They were a big force in the South African market.
How did you find joining them? Did you find it... relatively easy to fit in?
Well, yes, because you see, as I was a specialist in the rubber market, there was no difference. Mm. I just ran the rubber book as I had done previously, but of course I had more money to be able to spend on the book. Always previously, one was somewhat limited as to the funds which one could use. When I was with my father, we ran the rubber book on about 10,000 a year. When I was with C.D. Clark, it was probably about 15,000. When I joined Smith Brothers, it was about 60,000. But there again, you see, as time went by, of course, these shares were worth more in value. Mm. You know, in my father's day, they were only worth a few pence, so it's all rather relative. Mm.
Had you always been conscious of the of capital?
Oh yes, one has to be, because at times, of course, the interest rates were very high. But one always had to know the size of the book. Mm-hmm. It was something which one was always being asked in a small firm or with a big firm, they want to know what their commitment is. They want to know what you're a bull of and what you're a bear of. And that, of course, is most important too, when you're finding out how much is costing you to run a book. After all, there's how much you're paying the staff, how much you're paying in split accounts and interest charges. You work it out, and that is deducted from your gross profit, naturally, at the end of the year.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry.
No, what I was going to say was that, you know, we did make very good profits and our overheads were remarkably small.
Mm. Previous to joining Smith, had you been concerned that you didn't have adequate capital or you were just at the limits of your resources?
One was always rather worried about that because, you see, with my father's firm, there was a limit. He didn't want to buy. He was one of these people who didn't want to borrow money from the bank, whereas these days, of course, it's a completely different story. The more you borrow, the more popular you become. But he didn't like borrowing money from the bank. It was, you know, other Victorian ideas, and a lot of people wouldn't do so. So one had to keep the book under strict control. And if towards the end of the account,